Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Alex Chester Iwata, an actor and founder of the online publication Mixed Asian Media. Born out of a lack of representation across TV, film, and theater, Mixed Asian Media is a collective created by multiracial, mixed Asian Pacific Islanders who seek to build community through conversations of what it means to be of mixed API descent. In this conversation, we journey back to Alex's days as a young performer and the early pitfalls of the entertainment industry that later turned into motivation for her work as a founder and editor-in-chief. Alex, it's been, I don't remember. I looked at a conversation that we had recorded together because I was doing like asking people about self-care and their well-being, and we had a really great conversation. And I looked at the date for that project and it was like 2016. And oh my gosh, I bet so much has happened since 2016 to say the least. You know what I mean?
That's almost 10 years. I mean.
And that conversation, you were talking about, you know, you were talking about the previous iteration of Mixed Asian Media. I mean, it's still ongoing and everything, but that's how long it's been, you know, to put
wow.
it in.
Wow. Like, well, no, had Mixed Asian Media even started in 2016? I feel like Hoppa Mag started in 2017. We rebranded in 2021 to Mixed Asian Media. I was doing We So Hoppa before that. And then my blog, Me
yes.
So Hoppa. Oh my God, my blog.
And you did like a cabaret,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you were just starting to talk about, well, and also using like you were writing and just wanting to make a space for these things, you know, that are very important and it's becoming even more important. So Thank you for saying yes to like have a conversation on my little podcast project. But truthfully, I think like when we had met, we were doing like creative projects and I was trying to put up my play at one point, which I think is how we connected, because I had a character that I was like, no, this person has to be biracial. And it was like a whole learning experience for myself just to navigate like the complexities of that. And, you know, that made me connect with you. But I don't know too much about like your origin story. So I thought maybe it'd be nice to just hear a little bit about like
how Mixed Asian Media started.
Yeah.
Or of Alex.
I mean, let's start with intersectional, but let's start with Alex only because even I'm personally interested, because I know, for example, on your website, I didn't know that you had started modeling at such a young age. I mean, this has been like performance, auditioning. Yeah. It's been like a pretty big part of your life for a long time. Do you remember how that even got started?
So my mom had put me in dance classes when I was little, like four, maybe a little younger before that. And people would always go up to my mom and be like, oh my God, she's so pretty. She should be in modeling. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like fun. Let's do that. Cause I was such a ham as a child. It's so embarrassing. So embarrassing. Like, we would go into department stores and then I would just gravitate towards the clothing. And then all the, of course, sales clerks are like, oh my God, let's dress her up. And my mom was like, sure, go for it. And I would make my own little runway. Like it was, God, it's awful. So my mom didn't really know where to start off, but we ended up going with, I want to say it was like Colleen Claire Agency. Oh, it's such a blur. I started when I was five, started modeling, doing musical theater as well. I did my first show when I was five called Gigi at the Grand Inner Theater in Orange County. Now it's completely gone. It's a parking lot or probably part of Disneyland at this point, to be honest.
Go figure.
Yeah. And I had a really good career as a model until I hit 13. I ended up with Ford Models. And at the time, they were really, really big. And then they were like, you're 13. You're still 5'2". Yeah, you're not going to have a career anymore.
Oh.
So I was let go. But meanwhile, between all that, I started pursuing commercials as well. So I had done like my first commercial, I think, was like a Chevy Geo commercial. And then every single time I would be up for like a Mattel commercial for like Barbie, because I was doing a ton of Mattel work back then. Like my hand is on a ton of Mattel products, rollerblade Barbie, maybe a Bob Mackie Barbie as well, a bunch of them. They loved me for the modeling, but the feedback we got for me for commercials was she's just not Asian enough. So that was kind of the first like, oh, I'm this is gonna be different. It's gonna be hard for me. And then I still doing musical theater. I ended up in a pop group by Puff Daddy called Dream. This was when I was like 13.
This is all in LA, right? By the way.
Yeah. Okay. All in LA. Oh, and at one point when I was like 7 and 8, I worked on a cruise ship doing musical theater, a couple of shows as well. So yeah, I've had a very interesting career, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, I also worked on a cruise ship when I was 7 and 8 years old on the Norwegian Cruise Line. Flash forward. Sorry, this is a little bit jumping around because I'm just remembering things.
Yeah.
Flash forward 13. I was started in this pop group, which would eventually become Dream with Puff Daddy. That was a nightmare. Talk about abuse in the industry. Talk about just racism and the way they treated us, starved us, overworked us. The best thing that ever happened to me was they wanted us to sign a contract with Bad Boy Records, which is Puff Daddy's label, but without looking at the contract. Like, if you don't sign this, you're not in any longer.
Yeah.
My mom, being a lawyer, was like, she's not signing this. So I got out. They gave me, they bought my, bought out my contract. And the girls went on to do the record. I have since reconnected the girls now.
Oh my gosh.
A couple of them. And they were like, oh my God, you got out in the nick of time. We haven't seen any money. The abuse continued. I mean, it's just... it was also traumatic. Yeah. Looking back, I'm like, wow, that was some terrible times. To this day, I have a really hard time being in a recording studio.
Yeah.
Like, I just get basically PTSD. And I'm not sure if it's something I'm ever going to be able to work through, to be honest. But it's one of the reasons why I haven't really pursued voiceover, because I find it really traumatic to be in a confined space of a mic in front of my face, because I was screamed at and verbally abused so much in those type of rooms.
How old were you when Dream was
when their first single came out? I was 15 because I had just left.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Oh my gosh. And like, I'm just curious about this point, just because as a fellow person with like a musical background and knowing some of the things we have to like work through as an adult and everything, if you could find some like descriptive words about like what was so terrible about that experience, like what were some words that would come up for you?
Words, specific words, fat shaming.
Yeah.
Macro racism, and very blunt racism towards me, being the Asian person and Jewish person. I was told I was going to go to hell as a Jew, was forced to wear traditional Chinese garbs. I'm not Chinese. I am Japanese. I'm not even sure if there's any other specific words. It's just really a lot of abuse and a lot of gaslighting.
Yeah.
A lot of mind games, a lot of like tearing you down to then build you back up.
Right.
But it was basically being groomed. We were being groomed.
Yeah. And so, I had, like, the word that came up to me was like, you had to be like tokenized to form this group. It was like racially market researched.
Totally.
Coming together of a pop project kind of thing, you know?
Totally.
And I've heard similar stories, which is like no surprise, about musicians who really try to make it work and establish themselves. And
it's terrible.
Yes. Terrible. And, you know, it kind of makes me think about like your reaction to realizing how you're being perceived and these issues coming up. And I was looking back at our old conversation about like, what made you want to like, hey, I want to do something about this. And you know, when you started We So Hapa, and there's this line you talk about your family. You say, I come from a long line of strong women. I'm third generation on both my mom and dad's sides. My grandmother was an accomplished musician,
yep,
activist, and paralegal. My mom is an attorney, which you mentioned.
Yes.
So they were always encouraging of changing the world and making it a better place. My dad was the head of Parks and Recreation for Monrovia, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, the city of Monrovia. Yeah.
So, and he's done a lot with the environment. And, you know, the conversation went on to say, like, of course, it was a natural thing to look at an issue that was concerning you and then, like, try to contribute or, like, be proactive about it. And I was kind of looking at that little description. I was like, that makes sense, given your background, you know?
Yeah. I just got fed up. And while I had fun producing those cabarets with my friends, I didn't feel it was sustainable, because sadly, theater rarely is.
Yeah.
And then my own personal blog, I was like, I can't do this on my own anymore. So I had started doing research and looking in on various magazines that were out there for Asian Americans. And there was nothing specifically for the mixed API voice. I was writing for this other blog called Swirl Nation. And that was very much like all mixes, which is great. I think it was one of the first blogs out there. So I grabbed 9 mixed Asian friends and was like, what if we had our own magazine? There is literally nothing like it. And they agreed. I think they might regret this now. Really, we're so busy now. We started off as a quarterly online magazine, publishing 12 to 16 articles every quarter. And then in 2020, we were recognized by the Nielsen Consumer Report on Asian Americans. And we were listed as one of 3 online magazines. And that's when we kind of went, oh, this could be like an actual business. Like, this isn't just a hobby. We could do so much more of what this is.
Mm-hmm.
So then we decided to become an LLC. We decided to rebrand, and we decided to have the first ever Mixed Asian Media Fest in 2021.
Yeah, I saw that. Congratulations, yeah. By the way, with everything you just said, especially with the recognition by Nielsen. First of all, the fact that it was still only 3, I'm like, it's still unbelievable to me. Do you know what I mean? That it's still like very niche to consider a mixed identity, considering...
Well,
I mean, especially in the U.S. too.
Yeah, we are one of the fastest growing demographics, according to the U.S. Census. I feel like people really need to start taking a look at how they interact with mixed people, how they sell products to mixed people. I feel like we are a group that is often overlooked in consumership and in Asian American and BIPOC spaces.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to change.
Absolutely. And it's been an ongoing struggle, to say the least. And I've seen some of it, particularly within the Asian community, obviously. And it's at times heartbreaking, but I'm sure you know more about that.
Yeah.
But just for listeners who may not know, you mentioned your Japanese heritage. And then what about the other aspects of your mixed identity?
And then I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
Ashkenazi Jewish on my mother's side.
Oh, Ashkenazi.
So I'm like trauma on both sides of the family.
Yeah, my stepdad's family is, they're Ashkenazi Jews from... Minsk, Russia, I believe. So I've heard a little bit about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a learning experience, because it was important for me to learn more about my stepdad's like heritage and everything. And, you know, you learn about like what it took for them to like find their way to Nebraska and like start a local community.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. We're both, my grandmother's side is from Nebraska.
And she's Jewish?
She's Jewish. Yeah. Lincoln, Nebraska is where my family ended up.
My dad's side were primarily from Omaha, Nebraska, and they had like their own local like Jewish newspaper where they would like post published stories and stuff, because there wasn't really a publication that was for them. So I didn't know. I forgot about this. Maybe you mentioned it before, but I forgot that your Jewish side has a Nebraska origin, as do mine.
All places. My great grandfather was a tailor for the House of Worth in Paris. And he came from Russia to Paris, met my great grandmother.
Oh, wow.
Got married. But like, we've always been so confused. This tailor for the House of Worth, which was like the largest like fashion house of Paris at the time.
Yeah.
They decide to go to Lincoln, Nebraska. Not New York City, Lincoln, Nebraska. And it's just kind of like, huh.
No.
Why? I think he had some relatives possibly that had immigrated out there, but at the same time, it was just like, you went from Paris to Lincoln, Nebraska. Wild.
Yeah, I've often wondered that about myself, because my dad has taken me to Nebraska to show like, this is my childhood home. And I was quite young and kind of like flippant and was like, okay, I'm confused. Like, you know, I was kind of one of those. How does someone, another immigrant, a fellow immigrant family would wind up here? But it's true. Like, there are all these sort of miraculous, really interesting stories of people just wind up places. We have other family members, some Jewish family members in Ohio, some in like New Jersey, of course. And in any case, even though obviously I'm not half white, I remember like the feeling that I got when I heard my dad talking about his ancestors and where he comes from. And it also made me think about like, wow, it'd be good to know a little bit more about my Chinese family, you know, since I left so long ago. So anyway,
I love that.
Didn't know that we had that in common, but apparently Nebraska was
wild.
Poppin'.
Wild.
I don't know. I did want to go back and read the statistic you mentioned, because I highlighted it. I saw that you could be you're looking for some support for South by Southwest, right? For a panel. So
Yes. This
is a statistic that you mentioned. And the statistic is people of mixed heritage are the fastest growing identity group in the U.S. Over the past 10 years, the number of people identifying as mixed heritage increased by over 25 million in the U.S. It's so, in many ways, we had talked about this before, but it was like, wow, like here's a whole community of people who are kind of building bridges just by nature of people's relationships and their family and things like that. So for you, you've talked about when you were auditioning, things about your identity started bubbling up.
Oh, yeah.
To say the least. So could you give an example, because you have touched on this, how do you think the mixed heritage has impacted the way you navigate the entertainment industry? And how did it influence the way you consider and think about like identity, culture, and how to move through it and still like have your ambitions and stuff?
Yeah, I think it's changed a lot for me since when I started, because when I started, there weren't even mixed Asian roles available. So oftentimes I was lumped in like, well, I guess she can play Latinx because California, if you're anything not, if you can't, you're not put in a box, you're just seen as Latinx, which is terrible and racist. But keep in mind at the times that the late 90s, early 2000s, this was like, there were no words around this, right? There was no vocabulary and no one could say no. You could not say no to your agents. You could not say no to casting. You would immediately get like, have a bad reputation as a problem maker. And you couldn't say no.
Blacklisted, right?
Yeah, you would. You get blacklisted. So like a lot of it has changed since the Me Too movement and social media. So there really just wasn't the vocabulary to be like, huh, that's not me. I don't fit into that. I'm not comfortable portraying this. So my identity had definitely has changed. I was forced to try to be more Asian by my agents, like dye your hair darker or wait, don't go too dark or try to be more white. That's not really going to work. Yeah. So it was really just constantly being shoved in a box and constantly being told you're not enough. So it really just plays with your head and just really makes you feel anxious overall as a human, not knowing where you fit in, not knowing how to navigate being mixed at all. It is something I really had to figure out for myself. So there's all that. I would say now we have the vocabulary around like saying, no, you can't ask me that in the room. You can't say that. You can't ask me my heritage. It's just, you can't do that. And I tend to stand up a little too much where I'm like, no, you can't ask that. That's against the law.
Mm-hmm.
But baby Alex would have been like, oh, let me tell you what I am. I can remember I had a pre-read for Memoirs of a Geisha and they asked what my ethnicity is. And then the casting director proceeded to fight with me that she said I looked like I was Siberian. And I was like, Siberian, that's not a thing. That's a place. Yeah, I know. I can see your face. Yes.
Yeah, I know. I wish people could see my face right now because I don't have any other reaction to that, you know, of why that is a discussion. Yeah.
Like I literally lost out on contracts. I had a contract being drawn up with Disney for a major TV show. It was going to be one of the leads. And I thought it was a done deal. And then they pulled it for me last minute saying that I was too exotic next to the white lead and I would pull focus.
So again, it's touching on the either you're not quote unquote not exotic enough or too exotic. It can never just be like Alex or even, I mean, this is kind of shocking, I guess, for me as a layman, but like you can't be like just a brunette who's an American. Well, I don't know. You know what I mean? Which it's like.
And things have changed. Definitely have changed with the entertainment industry. You definitely see a lot more mixed Asians on screen, which is wonderful. There's a couple of TV shows that actually have like the mixed identity as part of the narrative, which is beautiful. And there's a lot more opportunities. I felt like I have had to pivot at some point in my career. It started becoming very popular to hire ambiguous actors. And that is definitely my niche is a ambiguous actor. I have made a decent amount of money doing national commercials as an ambiguous actor. I hate that word so much. I hate it. But, you know.
You had mentioned this before, too. Like, you were talking about, you know, being described as ethnically ambiguous and, like, just how it's how dehumanizing it is.
It is. It's like, what am I? I'm still a human being. I have a narrative. I have family. I have genetics. Like, it's just a complete erasure, to be perfectly honest. To me, it basically means, oh, she's a pretty prop that will make white people feel comfortable with something they're not necessarily are.
Dang, mic drop. But so real.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you for saying that, because as much as things have gotten better, given when the timing of when we're talking right now, clearly the entertainment industry is going through its moment of identity crisis, or however you describe it. And there are reasons for it, given the history of what you're talking about. But similarly, it did, I guess, in part, influence and birth mixed Asian media. And, you know, this collective.
It did.
Yeah, it really did. So what are some of your proudest, you've talked about some things, but what are some of your proudest moments for mixed Asian media?
The first proud moment was when being recognized by the Nielsen Consumer Report. That was a big deal. I remember it was the pandemic, and I was told, hey, you're going to want to be on the Zoom call that Nielsen is presenting. And I'm like, okay, why? And I was on it, and suddenly I started talking about mixed Asian media. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And I remember texting the group and saying, like, oh my God, we're recognized by the Nielsen Consumer Report. Oh my God. So that was like a really big moment. Another big moment for us was when we brought on Lauren Nguyen, who's the creative director. She's an incredible photographer that does a lot of fashion photography and is moving into K-pop more. Which I think is because of mixed Asian media. So I'm really proud of that. But anyways, we brought her in and we started doing these photo shoots. So we started doing cover shoots with celebrities and K-pop stars. And that's been a really awesome moment for us. And another big moment was the first time we hit a 1.1 million reach. That was like incredible to me that we actually had that.
Dang.
Yeah. And then so another cool fact.
Yeah.
From 2021 to 2022, we went from a 1.1 million reach to 5.4 million.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So that was another like, thank you. That was like another like, oh, wow. And also another thing is I'm always surprised, and I'm not sure why, but people will be like, oh, I know mixed Asian media. I've heard of this. I'm like, you have? I'm always so shocked that people have heard about us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Another big moment was I finally got to meet Keanu Reeves. I did the red carpet for the John Wick world premiere in New York City. So I met him. I've met some really cool people. I just interviewed Joe Coy at Here Lies Love red carpet. Daniel Dae Kim, AKA Daddy Dae Kim, as I call him. So like, those have been some really exciting moments. And just the fact that we've had a very successful festival this year, it's going to be very much pared down. One day event. We're not doing any screenings because we were supposed to do a couple of things with like some major networks, but due to the strike, it's not happening. But we decided to also start the first ever Mixed Asian Day. So that's another really big milestone for us is we're hosting the first ever Mixed Asian Day here in New York City. Because why not?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So why don't you tell everyone when it's going to be and how to look out for it or buy tickets if they wish? Yeah, please.
So it's going to be September 16th at Prime Produce Co-op, which is on 54th Street between 9th and 10th. Our fiscal sponsor is Leviathan Lab. One of our other incredible sponsors is the IW Group. We are hoping to have an all-day event starting like at around noon. The evening time will be a party. Probably in the daytime, we might have a marketplace of API vendors. I'm not sure yet, so please don't hold me to that, folks. To find out about it, you can check out our website, follow us on Instagram. You can subscribe to our newsletter. I am hoping this will happen, that we will raise enough money that this can be free to the public. But if not, I'm going to definitely keep it affordable.
Yeah. Yeah. So keep an eye out on the website for any updates and information. It'll be a fun event. Yeah. I hope to be able to check it out. Well, as an ally, you know.
Please come. Last year, our swag bags were lit. I had over 40 API sponsors. It was incredible. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is such an amazing project. Well, do you want to highlight some of the other folks that are involved? I mean, you know, maybe I can connect with them later. But yeah, tell us.
So, yeah, Sam Tanabe, I call him my right-hand man. I think we have only like two male-identifying folks as part of MAM. Right now, which is kind of funny. I'm not mad about it. So Sam is my managing editor. And then I have Lauren Hardy is an editor, a few other folks that are editors. Lauren Wynn is the creative director. Melissa Slaughter is one of my co-founders. Michaela Trinatsky-Holland is an advisor. And then I have a bunch of incredible writers that write for us. Jalen Jones, Ryan Cotter, Sally Weitzman, Erica Ito. I'm missing her last name. But we have like over 30 writers that come and go.
Yeah.
So that's kind of neat.
Yeah. It's a lot of contributing voices. Yeah.
It is a lot of contributing voices. And then we also have a really cool partnership with Joy Sauce, which is another Asian-led media platform. So we share our articles with them. And it's been a wonderful relationship. I really love this group.
So I'm curious for you personally as like the founder, how does doing this work, does it like influence the way you approach like your work as a performer or when you're doing like auditions and things like that?
Yeah, so I've actually taken a step back from some performing. I've had a conversation with my agents where I no longer want to do theater at this point in my career. It's unless it's something I'm like, oh my God, yes. Like last year I had the most incredible opportunity and I played for the first time a mixed Asian in an off-Broadway play. And that was with King Company's The Space Between Us. So that was wonderful. But I realized during that process that it's really hard to work 60 hours on mixed Asian media and also do a show.
Yeah.
It's just really hard. Something's going to give. So because of that, I decided that I need to see Mam. I have to see where Mam goes. I have to see it through. We're like so close to becoming sustainable, in my opinion, and just talking to people. And we're just making such great strides that I would regret not seeing it through. So I talked to my agents and they were like, no, this is incredible what you're doing. We support you fully. Let us know if you want to come back to theater. But in the meantime, we'll still submit you for other things. And I'm like, great. So yeah. Because of that, I don't really audition right now. Honestly, I don't have the time.
Yeah.
I barely have time to see my friends, my family, and my husband. I am flying back and forth to LA constantly between the board of directors I sit on for American Advertising Federation's LA chapter, between the board I sit on for New York's ACE Next Gen chapter. It's just a lot of other work I do for and around MAM and the events I have to cover. So it's something had to give.
Yeah.
Oh, another cool thing we did. We covered the Golden Globes early this year.
The Golden Globes? Wow.
Antanabe was on the red carpet.
Oh my gosh.
I forgot about that.
That is so amazing. Congratulations. And I totally understand about what you're saying. It's like sometimes you need to prioritize for a while, especially when you see all the signs, right? And in some ways, I think that's also a respect to the craft, where it's like, you know how much dedication doing something like a play run would take, right?
And honestly, I found out during the pandemic, a show I was supposed to do got canceled. And instead of being devastated, I was relieved.
Mm.
And that was a big like light bulb for me going, huh, maybe I don't really want to do this anymore.
Is there more you want to say about that or like the theater world?
I mean, I've been in the industry for so long since I was 5. And it's kind of all I ever knew. And I really lost myself as far as like, I didn't even know who I was up until I would say quite recently as a human. And that's been a lot of therapy to get me to that. I have a lot of trauma surrounding theater and the experiences that I've had. It's because all I knew as a child was extreme highs and extreme lows. Whether you get a role or don't get a role, either you do a good job or you don't get a job, is affected the way my relationships, who I date, all of that. It's affected how I consent works with me. I have a hard time saying no to things. And that's, I think, all because of being in the industry since I was a child.
Because you've had to learn to like hustle and try to get as many yeses as possible, like that kind of muscle.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And also like as a child, you're taught to smile, you can't be upset. You can't be sad. You can't say, no, that makes me uncomfortable. I don't want to do that. So I was basically told not to trust my gut instincts, not to trust when I didn't want to do something. So I just was always told to say yes. And that in turn has reflected itself as an adult.
Yeah.
So I really had to work on all of this and like kind of get back to base level. And through that, I've really realized that maybe I don't want to do theater. I don't get the joy out of it. Sometimes I get panicky in a theater-like situation, and I have to choose myself first and my mental well-being first.
I don't talk about this very often, but it's taken me until very recently to even kind of be able to enjoy and go back to, this is so random and specific, but like classical concerts, because I would kind of get worked up. Like I should be prepared. And I'm just like, what is this? It's been decades, quite literally, that to like go on stage of that magnitude. And I was like, oh my God, I can hear like an old piece I used to play and my palms would get sweaty. You know, it's so, you know what I'm saying?
I feel you on that 100%. I absolutely feel you. So I would like to get to the point where I'm starting to enjoy going to theater again. There was a hot spot there where like,
yeah,
couldn't do it. Could not sit through a show without like having a panic attack. And now I do enjoy going to the theater, and I just have to be very picky about what it is I see. So
yeah,
we're getting there. It's a work in progress. Anyone who says that the entertainment industry doesn't have trauma is living under a rock.
Yeah. You know, you brought up such important points for creatives, artists, and performers, as far as like taking care of their well-being, their energy, their mental, physical health, all of it. What are some like themes or topics that have come up, for example, within mixed Asian media that's full of, you know, creatives, performers, artists? What are some of the common struggles, like the one that you've mentioned?
The common struggles are just there not being roles made for us, and there's not enough people behind the table that look like us making these creative decisions. It's still having to bow down to the white people that are making the decisions. It's changing, but I really do believe, like, my biggest thing I'll say to people is, if you don't see it, create it, whatever that means to you. Like, if you don't see a script that calls to you, then you write it. I'm not saying it's going to get published. We hope it does 100%, but at least you're putting it out there and making the effort. I think that's the biggest thing, is not just like letting the status quo affect you. You can change things. Like, I feel like we've seen a difference already with how mixed people are starting to be perceived in the industry. And I like to think it's a little bit because of mixed Asian media and the work we've been doing by highlighting artists and activists and community leaders and small business owners. But yeah, so I just think that like people shouldn't be afraid to, one, say no, they don't want to do something, and two, ask for what they want. And I think people are so scared to ask for what they want. But I always think like, what would a cis white male do? And then I try to do it. And then another thing is, I think something for me is trying to create the mindset of abundance, because I feel like there is very much within the entertainment industry and in general across all industries, specifically when it comes to POC people, is the scarcity mindset, that there can be only one, that we have to gatekeep so I can keep the resources to myself, mm-hmm. right? But really, if we support each other and we are show up for each other, then we're creating more and more resources for our community, and we don't have to gatekeep that.
Yeah. Well, you're reminding me of the story with Constance Wu a little bit after the success of Crazy Rich Asian. She spoke about that, just, you know, sometimes you're surprised by the reaction within, quote unquote, your own community. And similarly, it makes me want to ask, you know, speaking to, let's say, the API community who are not mixed, how can we support more inclusivity and representation for people who are mixed, and for like communities like mixed Asian media, would you say?
I would say like, maybe start to change your mindset of what it means to be Asian American here, because being Asian American can mean so many different things. It can mean you're Black and Asian, Puerto Rican and Asian. It can mean so many things. And I think we are so set on the East Asian, that is Asian, but there's so much more. We're a huge diaspora. Honestly, Asian American doesn't even cover how many people have. I mean, it's just such a small word that covers so many different minority groups and ethnic groups, right? And I think it's a matter of like being mindful of that, and being mindful of a lot of people I've talked to that I call them model racials, the full Asian folks. And they're like, oh, my cousin's mixed, or, oh, Yeah. My nieces and nephews are mixed, and I never thought of these struggles that they would have. And wow, this is giving me a lot of food for thought. So I think it's just being open to hearing these stories and being mindful of it, and then being willing to talk to either your kids, your cousins, your nieces and nephews about their mixed identity and making them feel seen and heard. And I think that's something that the community could definitely do, is just making sure that they are inclusive and it's not just Asian, that it's Asian American, which is a very, very broad term. And there's so many people that fall underneath it.
Yeah. And that term, like if you go to Asia, that word quickly loses, like it loses its meaning, because you'd have to be so much more specific, you know, about who you are. But I think that word is still very much meaningful in the diaspora, like you say, and there is that like nuance.
Oh, totally. I mean, I went to Thailand for the first time earlier this year. It was my first trip to Asia ever, and it was a whole new world and experience that opened up for me. And I'm going to Japan for the first time in end of September and October, and I'm the first Iwata to go back in three generations. And my best friend Melissa, who is one of the co-founders of MAM, I was like, you know, it's interesting. I don't feel like I'm coming home to the motherland. I really do feel like an American going to visit this country for the first time. And she's like, you know, you're absolutely right, because they will look at you and go, huh, she might be mixed Asian, but she's loud and she dresses like an American and she speaks like an American. She is not Japanese. She is Japanese American. And I know, because I'm third generation. I just am. Like,
yeah.
My dad didn't speak Japanese. I don't speak Japanese. Like, I know people are kind of scoff at a simulation, but let's be real, the Japanese Americans were forced to after internment. So
yeah, I think what you're pointing to is so poignant in many ways. Like, we're all trying to understand and connect with each other. And ultimately, I think a lot of what makes this meaningful is like, that's what it's about. And we're in so many ways, we're disconnected from our own roots. Even for those I know, like even for those who live in Asia, there's that sense of feeling lostness, like, who am I? And that's such a common struggle that I think we can find a lot more like empathy for each other over, ideally, you know.
I think so too.
Yeah. So you've got the festival that is coming up, which people should totally check out. Is there anything else that you want to make sure to spotlight?
Let's see, September 7th, American Advertising Federation will be in LA. We'll be having our first meetup. So that'll be fun. If you're in LA, please come out, say hello. I promise we're nice people. And then obviously September 16th, Mixed Asian Day, Mixed Asian Media Fest in New York City. November 10th, we're partnering with Asia Society here in New York City for an event. So stay tuned for more details on that. I think that's really it for now. We're in the works of a podcast. We're in the works of some other things, which is very vague, but I have to be vague right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, totally. You know, we have a lot happening. Oh, and I'm really excited about this. And this is, I just found out I'm going to be part of the Gold House's Journalist Accelerator program. So I'm really excited about that.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Also that part, the training you received was just like in the moment, which I want to highlight that. Because that says something about, like, I don't know, I like to say the power of artists. It's like, we know how to be struggling artists, but not like be a victim about it. We just like have to be scrappy and like imagine a whole set or whatever. You know, we're used to just like doing things and taking care of things. And I see that with like everything that you've established without.
I just make it up as I go. And so far it's been working. I got a BA in dance in 2021, which I'm never using. But, you know, here we are. And
congratulations, though.
Thanks.
The way you said it, it's made me laugh so hard. BA in dance. Hey, we got to take care of our body too, right? So I love it.
I mean, I didn't have to dance or anything because it was through this credible program called LEAP, which is through St. Mary's in California. And it's for performers that either are wanting to still dance or perhaps move on in their career. So we had like ABT ballerinas in this class. I mean, it was really cool. And it's just, you get credit for all the years of work that you've done, but you have to prove your knowledge, write a bunch of essays and like watch videos and then talk about the movement and how it was inspired by X, Y, and Z. So it's not just like,
gotcha,
here's a degree, let me see your resume. That you really do have to prove your knowledge. And of course, all the other classes you have to take in order to get a college degree. But it just makes me laugh. I'm always like, huh, I have this degree that I will never use.
I feel like so many people would resonate with that right now. They're like, oh, speaking my language.
Yeah. No, it's like the furthest from the field I currently am in, like truly, which is fine. It's fine.
Watch you say that and some random shit is going to happen that's going to be like, oh, like a random like dance performance opportunity related to mixed Asian or something. Like, it's just...
Oh my God.
You know what I mean?
Something will happen. And I'm going to be like, okay, let's get grandma in shape now. Start to create some stretches.
Okay, well, I would love to catch up in person.
Yes.
When you have the chance. But thank you so much for just like taking the time to share a little bit about your journey. So much has happened for you and Mixed Asian Media since we last connected, and truly is inspiring and brings me hope. So thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. Listeners are welcome to connect with me over Instagram and LinkedIn. You just have to search my name, and I love to hear from you. If you'd like to learn more about my work as a coach and artist, please visit www.robertkwanghome.com.